It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
It's time for episode 194 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great interview with Aaron Lopresti, the creator of a new comic from Dark Horse called Power Cubed. We talk about how this book came to be and the characters in it, as well as Aaron's style of writing and creating of characters. You'll hear what kinds of things he's challenging himself on the book, as well as other things he just enjoys including in the things that he makes. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. Welcome to the podcast, Aaron Lopresti, and the artist and a writer on a great comic that's coming out very shortly called Power Cubed from Dark Horse. How are you doing today, Aaron?
I am great, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to talk with you. I had the chance to read the first issue of Power Cubed, and I want to make sure it has the D on the end because some people may not see it. Because the way it is on the comic, it's got a power with a 3 in superscript. And some folks might not realize there's a D on the end of that. We want to make sure people can access this book. So
well, that was my attempt at being cute and clever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's power to the third, basically, which would be power cubed.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's a math teacher, so I try to work in some math jokes whenever I can. But that was kind of the joke with the title that I thought might be clever if people were able to figure it out, which when you do stuff like that, you never know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true. I think the book is a great book. There's lots of humor in it. And as I was saying before we started recording, it's not necessarily a funny book in the sense that, you know, the way comics used to be. It's a book that has a lot of adventure to it. And there is a lot of fun segments and there's a lot of humor involved, too, which, as I was saying, I don't think there's enough of that in comics today. You know, as a big Batman fan as I am, I think things are too dark sometimes and we need things to lighten the mood a little. And I think that Power Cubed is really good at that. There's a lot of parts where I had to laugh out loud when I saw some stuff in it. So he did a great job on balancing adventure and action versus comedy and humor and, you know, character as well, too. So all this stuff I thought was really good. And you were saying to me before we started to record that this is a concept you've had for a while.
Yes, way back in the mid-90s. It's funny to say that, isn't it? Way back in the mid-90s. But I was in a studio in Portland, Oregon called Studio Soros, and it was a bunch of comic book artists, Terry Dodson, Matt Haley, Ron Randall, Carl Kiesel was in there, Rachel Dodson, of course, was in there, Matthew Clark, Randy Emberlin, Gary Martin. And after about a year of the studio, I thought, you know, we should try and do some publishing. We have this talent here. Let's do something. And so a few of us, me, Ron, I think Terry was kind of loosely involved, as well as Matt Haley, and we had come up with a line of books. We were going to call it the Odyssey line, and we thought we could launch through Image Comics. And so I came up with actually a dinosaur comic first, and I did about 8 pages of that. It was kind of a sci-fi dinosaur thing, and everybody's like, Aaron, no one's going to buy a dinosaur book. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. So I dumped that, and I have to admit, I don't recall exactly all that went into the creation of Power Cubed, but at the time it was called Atomic Toy Box. And it was basically the same story. I went ahead and rewrote it, and hopefully it's better than its original incarnation 15 years ago. But that book was the first one to launch out of this Odyssey line that we were going to do as a studio. And I think my book came out the first issue, and Ron Randall's Trekker came out with one issue. And we were probably a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of having the idea to do this, because a lot of us were just sort of establishing ourselves in the industry at that point and didn't really have enough name recognition to pull something off like that. And so sales on the first issue were okay. But then, as I learned quickly, that sales usually drop 50% on the second issue. And so we got hit with the pre-orders on that. And it was like, wait a minute, I'm losing money if I do this book. So I stopped. And so there was this one issue of Atomic Toy Box, which is now Power Cubed, been sitting there for 15 years. I know a lot of people that bought it, and they often come up to me at conventions and ask, are you ever going to finish this? Well, are you ever going to finish this? And so I've had guilt for, you know, a decade and a half over this. And it was, I want to say 3 years ago or so in New York, at the New York Comic Con, Mike Richardson, publisher at Dark Horse, approached me and said, hey, if you have a creator-owned book or something, or, you know, something you're interested in doing, he goes, I'd love to see it. And I said, well, you know what, Mike, there just so happens I have this thing. And so I, you know, over the years, you develop all sorts of ideas and things and concepts for series or stories. But I kept saying, before I do anything else, I've got to finish this. I owe this to the people that bought that issue 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I pitched it to Dark Horse. They liked it. So I went ahead and wrote the entire miniseries. It's a 4-issue miniseries. Mm-hmm. And then started drawing. And this has been a long, drawn-out process because anytime you're doing a creator-owned book, usually the pay isn't what it is at DC or Marvel. Mm-hmm. In my case, DC, where I've been at for the last 7 or so years. Mm-hmm. So I had to do this kind of as a side project. You know, wherever I had free time, I would draw pages. And so it's taken a long time to get to this point, but it's actually going to happen. The first issue is colored and lettered and ready to go. Obviously, you've read a preview of it. So, and I'm about a third of the way through the fourth issue right now. So it will be done and out on time, although it took me quite some time to get here.
Well, it's a good way to do it is to don't release it until you're ready. And even if it takes time, it's better to get it out because, you know, I always remember the Frank Miller story. Dark Knight Returns came out, number one. Number two came out a month later, and then number three came out 6 months later, and then number four came out a year later. And
that's right. We were sitting around waiting for that fourth issue forever, thinking, what's going on?
I didn't think it was going to come out in my lifetime, so I was just, you know, I thought, so this is the thing. It's much better to do it the way you're doing it. And, you know, given the quality of the book, too, I think people are going to really enjoy it. I like it quite a lot. That mix of humor and character and stuff. One of the things I noticed that I really liked was there's a parallel between the quote-unquote good family and the quote-unquote evil family in the fact that their father-son relationships are kind of being compared. I really liked the way that you did that. Did you have something like that? You must have a son or something, or is that what inspired you to do these kinds of good things?
Well, you know, it's funny. I do have kids, and I do have a son who's now, shockingly, 22 years old. But the germ, I guess, of the idea for the relationship between Kenny and his father really came from me and my dad. Mm-hmm. I got along great with my dad. This isn't going to be some horror story where, you know, I had this tragic upbringing or anything. But my dad was never very, most dads of his generation, kind of, you know, they worked all the time. They came home. You had a little time with them in the evening, but, you know, you didn't really have that. A lot of people didn't, at least in my case, didn't have that close-knit relationship with him. I got along with him great. We always seemed to be able to talk about sports fine, but anything that was really sort of serious or intimate that you want to talk about, I always, you know, had those conversations with my mom. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later in life that my dad and I really connected on a much deeper level. Mm-hmm. So this is more of a Kenny's problem communicating with his father, although it's a bit exaggerated here for, you know, laughs and points, but it really is kind of reflective of my relationship that I had with my father, which was you get to a certain point in the conversation, then beyond that point, you're like, you know, I really don't know what to say here. You know, so it's more that than it is a relationship that I've had with my son, because I really tried to make good effort to always have better communication with my son than I necessarily did with my dad. So.
Jack, I can relate to that because my dad was that way too. It must be from the same generation. It was tough to talk with him, and we would watch sports at times, often football, and he would always turn to me and ask, which team are you rooting for? So we would root for the same team. And he was always kind of like that, but he was a nice, quiet guy. There were worse dads that I saw, and I was very happy that he was my father. But you're right, communication was not his strong suit. So I could relate to some of these good things. Now, the good thing is, too, is that Kenny's father is a scientist who comes up with something and gives it to him for his birthday. And I love the kids, Kenny's reaction to it when he sees it. Here's this thing that can basically do anything. And I love the subtitle of the book. Why don't you tell people what the subtitle of the book is?
That's a tagline that Dark Horse put on there. So I
You didn't have anything to do with
that. Create anything.
Oh, okay. No. Okay. I thought that was something you did. But yeah, that's
no.
That's
they did all the marketing stuff on that, and they'd send it to me for approval, and I'd go, "Yeah, that's great. Good thinking. Use that." You know,
what is it again?
I can't remember. I think it is. What if you could create anything?
Yeah, that was kind of the thing. I like that. And his first reaction is, "I'm going to make a bunch of money." He goes,
"Yeah."
And I thought that was so funny because, you know, I hate to tell you something, but it's not our generation, I guess, but if you do that with a younger generation thing, the first thing they think goes, man, I'm going to make all kinds of money with this. And it's just so funny to me.
The challenging thing, I guess, for me writing this was your inclination is, you know, if someone came up to you and said, hey, if you had this piece of tech that could change, you could make anything you wanted out of something else, what would you make, you know? And you know, people, you'd get these answers of giant robots, or I would do this, or I'd do that. But as I was writing this, I was thinking, okay, what would you really do? You'd be in shock, first of all, you know? So it's kind of like, how fast would your brain really wrap around the concept that you could make anything? So I tried to approach it in a way that, I guess, believable, if that makes any sense. If a situation like this could actually exist, how would an 18-year-old react? You know, the first thing you're thinking of is you're not going to sit there and start creating all these elaborate things. I think it's going to start slowly, and you're going to start thinking, well, maybe I could turn this toaster into a little robot. Wouldn't that be funny? Or a car or something. And then as you sit around and start to think about it, and what the possibilities, then it starts to get bigger. You know what I mean? And so I tried to keep it as a kid getting this, not really understanding what he had in his hand, you know? And so that would be, like you said, what would an 18-year-old do? And it's like, oh my gosh, I just made this. We can make a fortune with this, you know? And it's like, instead of thinking, I'm going to go make a transformer out of the car and I'm going to do this and that, you know? So that was sort of how I had to almost reel myself in, because it's easy to sit at the drawing board and go, okay, let's think of all the amazing things I would do if I had this cube. Well, what's this kid going to think on the spur of the moment? He might think he had time to sit down and think about it, but he's going to react on his gut initially anyway. And so that's what I tried to do. And that's kind of, I think, what came out of that line came out of.
Oh, you know, it just dawned on me. There's a dinosaur in this book. It's just because you're talking about you had done a dinosaur book. And I thought, oh, maybe you kind of slid that in there just for your own pleasure to have a dinosaur in this book somehow.
I'm a big dinosaur guy. So anytime I could work that in, and I think, and Kenny, he is in a lot of ways very self-reflexive because he is an artist. And in the original incarnation of this book, when it was Atomic Toy Box, he wasn't an artist. And I thought, you know, if this kid's going to have this fertile imagination to create stuff, he must already have this fertile imagination. So how would he be expressing that? And I thought, well, you know, maybe he's an artist. You know, it makes perfect sense to me. And so I interjected that in there to kind of give him a built-in creative sensibility that would make more sense logically, I think. And so I thought, well, there's an 18-year-old kid who's into, and I think I tried to set up early in the book, I don't want to give too much away if people haven't read it, but that he has an imagination, you know, and that there's stuff floating around in his head that's pretty cool. So by the time we get to the point where he turns the staircase into a T-Rex, I don't think that's a surprise that he might do that, you know, on the spur of a moment. But again, that comes from me too, because I'm a big dinosaur guy. So obviously now Kenny's a big dinosaur guy.
Another thing I really like too, at the very beginning of the book, there's a dream sequence going on. And he's talking to a parent, shall we say. We won't give too much away there. But that reminded me of experiences I have occasionally, you know, because my dad had passed. And I dreamed one time I was talking with my father, and I said to my father, I said, Dad, I said, aren't you dead? And my father turns to me and says, well, it's your dream.
No kidding.
Yeah. So when I read that, the sequence that's in there, and I don't want to give anything about it, but it reminded me of that experience that I had. And so we're on the same wavelength, it seems like, with all these good things.
I guess. Lots of fun. Guess. That's
I got
amazing.
I got a kick out of that. And so it's a great book. I think that the characters are strong. And I like that, of course, your artwork is great, too. I've always enjoyed your artwork. And the fact that you've written a lot, too, really shows in this book. Because I wasn't familiar with your past as a writer. I've seen your artwork and really enjoyed it, but I didn't understand that you had also a lot of writing experience as well. And there are some wonderful bits in here. There's some comedy stuff that I can't say because it's integrated into the story. And I think that's a sign of a good writer to me, is when the humor pours out of the story instead of I need a bit of humor here. Let me throw this line. It has absolutely nothing to do with going on in there. But you let the humor flow out of the situation, and I think that was a great way to do it.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you saying that. It's a bit of a pet peeve of mine. And see, I went to film school at USC, and so I got a lot of training in terms of screenwriting and putting stories together. And nothing bugs me more than, I use a good example, my daughter loves Despicable Me.
Yeah. You know?
And they, of course, all the kids love the Minions, right? But if you watch that first movie in Despicable Me, the first one, they always cut away to Minions, and what they're doing is funny, but it has nothing to do with the story. You know, like they're Xeroxing their butts or whatever, and they're, in and of themselves, they're funny scenes, but they're not, I don't think, properly integrated into the story. The humor isn't necessarily, at least with those characters, coming out of the story. They're just thrown in there for random comic relief. And you know, as I was telling her, she's just like, ah, you know what you're talking about, Dad. you know, I was saying that this would be much more effective if they had worked these characters in to give us more jokes that were directly integrated into the plot rather than just, let's take a sidebar for a couple seconds and get a few laughs from these characters. And I think that if you're going to do humor, if you're, you can do anything in a story, you don't want to pull people out of the story just so you can crack a joke, or you don't want to pull people out of the story just so you can show an explosion, or whatever the case may be. You want these things to be naturally integrated into the story. And I think when it does that, it, I think you get laughs out of the surprise that, oh my gosh, I can't believe he just said that. Or in the case where some of the instances you just referenced were that, oh my gosh, you know, that's exactly what I would have said. Or that's exactly what, you know, an 18-year-old I know would have said. And that's why it becomes funny. Whereas opposed to it's just, hey, stop, look, here's a joke, let's move on. A lot of times that stuff isn't funny. So again, I appreciate you seeing that in it, and it makes me feel good that it worked, at least in the first issue so far.
That's great. I'm looking forward to the other issues, too. Now, we've got to talk a little bit about the bad guys in the story, because they're quite good. I don't know if you want to reveal the name of the opposite number to the father.
Well, some of this stuff, I know a lot of people that will be picking up this book didn't see Atomic Toy Box, but Dr. Cool was the villain in the original, and I have released a couple of panels here and there, certainly with his name attached to it. But again, if we're going to go back, and I'm trying, I honestly, and this is terrible, but especially for an interview, that I can't remember what the seed that grew, that Dr. Cruel, where that whole concept came from, other than the fact that I thought, you know, it might be funny if we had, because there's more stuff going on there. Obviously, he has a brain, and we don't know whose brain it is, and there's something going on with that. And there is some ideas that, I'm trying to figure out how I can say this without giving anything away. Let's just say there's some older films that sort of inspired me and some of the ideas that I used with him and his brain, although I've got this set up so that things are not exactly probably what people are thinking they're going to be. Let's just put it that way. But the actual origin of that character, I mean, it's always fun to use Nazis as a villain. You know, you got a built-in symbol that everybody automatically hates. There's no one sympathetic. I guess maybe neo-Nazis might be. I don't know. But normal people, you know, are not sympathetic to Nazis. And so you've got this built-in thing that you can make fun of without offending anybody. You can make the villain, they're already as dastardly and despicable as they could possibly be before he even starts. So there's all that stuff kind of built into him that makes him fun to play with in a story like this.
Well, cruel is a great word to call him, because in a way it's over the top, which is a great thing. And I like the fact that his appearance and everything, it just screams out over the top a little bit to me. And that's the kind of thing you want in a situation where you've got the incredible basically going on, with the power cube thing happening. You need somebody who is going to be able to match that, or else it's going to be, the things are going to just go, it'll be over in one issue as far as that goes. So you've developed an opposite number, I think, that's just perfect. And I have to say, the people that he hired through the internet were just hilarious. God, I busted out laughing when I read that. He makes a comment, something to the effect of that, don't ever hire underlings through the internet. And I laughed out loud when I read that. I thought it was a great thing. They remind me a little bit of Sam and Twitch. A little bit. You know, I was looking at it and I was going like, that's not Sam and Twitch, is it? Is this where they've come? they're now out on the internet being hired?
Not intentionally.
Okay. That's good.
You know, it is funny how often you, even just in comics, I'm sure it obviously happens in movies and other creative outlets as well, but how oftentimes you come up with, oh my gosh, this is such a great idea, whether it's a cover design or maybe even kind of a story idea or a twist or something. And then you find out after you've done it, oh, yeah, so-and-so did that two years ago, and something you've never seen, you know, and yet there it is almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
I did a for Marvel, I'm going to say, my gosh, it might have been almost 9 years ago. They did a miniseries called Hulk Destruction that was apparently sort of loosely based on a video game that was out at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd asked me to do a cover for it with the Hulk fighting the Abomination. So I drew this cover, and I had it with me at San Diego Comic-Con, and someone came up and was looking at the artwork and goes, wow, is this sort of an homage to the cover that Mike Zeck did on a Hulk annual? And I was like, what? I go, I have no idea what you're talking about. The guy pulled it up on the computer screen or whatever on his phone and shows it to me. It was almost exactly the same.
Oh,
I mean, I could not believe it, and I had never seen it before. So, I mean, that stuff happens all the time, you know.
Oh,
And,
I'll have to tell you a quick story.
Like I say, I may have ripped off something, but it wasn't intentional if I did.
Well, let me tell you a quick story, because a friend of mine is developing a book, and it's called Stabbity Bunny. And there's in the very first issue, there's it's a little dark in the sense that she gets kidnapped as a seven-year-old girl that gets kidnapped in the first issue. And the person who kidnaps, we was showing it to somebody, and the one guy looked at us and said, oh, that's such and such from Spawn number 3. And we're all going like, who? But it wasn't the same, but it was just sort of funny that this person could remember Spawn number 3 right away, and say, it's that character. So it's not uncommon what you've gone through. Let's face it, the creative process is such that you put certain elements together and aggregate them. You're going to get certain things with certain creative processes. And I just think that, you know, that's a sign of being creative, not so much as being you're ripping something off. Is that you knew how to do this, and then you followed the same process that the other person did, totally separate.
Yeah, and you come up with nearly the same conclusion. That is, it's interesting. But it's oftentimes true. You know, they always say the old cliches, there's nothing new under the sun, and that may be true. We're all just kind of retreading the same ideas and trying to present them differently. But we always think when we're coming up with them that they're original, and no one's ever done anything like this before. But it's usually not the truth.
Nope. Well, it doesn't take anything away from the book either. I don't want people to think that this is not a very creative book. It is. There's a lot of great stuff going on in it. The characters are well-defined, and they breathe, as far as I'm concerned. And there's good things going on. It doesn't slow down the pace at any point. Things are very interesting. If something's happening, if there's exposition going on, it's important to pay attention to it as far as the story goes. And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about, and one thing that most people probably know you for, is your artwork. And your artwork in here is very dynamic. It's very easy to tell what's going on. It moves real quickly. It keeps your eye going from panel to panel to know what's going on, and I really like that, you know. So I don't want to give your artwork short shrift here either, because I think it really looks great. I think the cover was particularly good. I think all the different panels and stuff work so nicely, and you can tell people from each other, which I like, because some comics, I look at them and I go like, now wait a minute, which character just said that? You know, I don't have trouble with that with yours, which I think is great. So, you know, I want to say, too, that I think the artwork is really spectacular. I really like it. And, you know, if people get it just for the art, I think they're going to be very pleasantly surprised by how great the story is, too.
Well, thank you. One of the things I always try to do, at least artistically, is try to give your characters somewhat of a unique look. It gets more challenging when you're just drawing superheroes and superheroines. It's the girl's the beautiful girl, and the guy is the handsome, studly guy, and they all sort of can kind of blend in together. But when you do something like this, where especially with a humorous element to it, you can really exaggerate the personalities physically of the characters, and it really helps make them unique when you're able to do that. And I tried to make that an emphasis going into this, that I was going to have characters that were characters, you know, both physically and in terms of their personalities and stuff. And so Kenny's maybe a little on the generic side in terms of good-looking 18-year-old kid, but he's the only one in the story, so you know, I don't have any other good-looking 18-year-old kids running around in there. He's got all these other, you know, his dad and of course the henchmen, and Dr. Cool of course is off on his own in terms of design. But you'll see that in my work a lot, especially in the secondary characters. I always try to, when it doesn't matter what they really look like, you can really push the looks of characters to give them a unique look and stuff. I tend to, like most guys, when you're drawing the heroes and the heroines in the stories, that they're the most statuesque and beautiful and all that kind of stuff. But when you get to the supporting characters where that stuff doesn't matter, that's when I can have a little fun with them. And thankfully, there's a lot of them in this story that allow me to do that.
Well, you also do great with robots. And there's a robot that shows up about two-thirds of the way through. And he's got the greatest name for a robot ever. He's called Click, and I just think that's the greatest name. When I read that, I said, oh, man, somebody should have called a robot that long before this. And that's the greatest name for the robot, and his relationship to what's going on is great, great fun, too. So all these things really nicely tie together.
Well, thank you. He plays a big role going forward, and I won't... You know, I don't want to give that away, I don't think, at this point. But some of it's hinted at the end of the first issue when he describes to Kenny who he is and what his relationship is with Kenny's father in terms of his creation and stuff. And so that gets developed more down the line. So he's a very integral part of the story. And we'll get another, the Power Blaster, which is featured on the cover of the first issue, he comes up and becomes a integral part as well. But he's more of the strong, silent type, where Click is really the close friend of Kenny through all of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big tech guy, so I like to challenge myself to do stuff. I'm more of a, like I said, dinosaur jungle kind of artist, and the tech stuff is something that doesn't come naturally to me, so it's like I like to challenge myself with things like that and say, okay, you know what, I'm going to put robots in this, and I am going to do my best to make them look cool, and stuff of that is always sort of hit and miss, but I think at least on the two main ones in here, I'm pretty happy with the design on them. So,
I'll have to tell you a quick story about the guy who played Commander Riker in Star Trek: The Next Generation. He was at a convention, and some guy in the audience got up to the microphone and said, "You know, I don't understand how warp drive works. If this goes this way and you do this to this and that and the other, how in the world can all this work together?" And of course, his response is he broke out in singing Volare, you know, in the top of his lungs. And we all busted out laughing, you know, because that was, you know, he didn't understand this stuff, and why in the world would he even try? But here's this guy trying to get a very serious scientific answer out of the actor, and he's singing Volare, whoa, on and on, he's going, and the guy's kind of getting a little frustrated with him, but the rest of us are dying laughing. Because that doesn't matter. That has nothing to do with what, you know, we don't have to understand the tech. We just need to know that it functions, and it functions in a certain way. So I think I was worried that you were going to try to explain all the tech, and then we'd get lost in the tech aspects of it. It's much better to tell the story and have things work than to try to sit there and tech us. So I think you're doing the right thing with that.
Well, there is, gosh, I want to see, when is it? I think the third issue, Kenny runs into a bit of a... it's a small thing, but the cube not working the way he thought it would work. And so we do have a slight explanation. I'll warn you, it's certainly not explaining how warp drive works, but I did try to create parameters for it. You know, so you didn't have like a situation like what DC has been struggling with Superman for years is you got this guy who's so powerful, who could ever fight him, you know? So I wanted to give the cube great power, but I also wanted to give it some sort of working limitations in terms of what it could do or what the person operating the cube was expected of, what they had to bring to the table to make it work. And so there's a little bit of that in there just for the sake of someone sitting there going, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would he do that? So, you know, when that comes up, I'll take a couple word balloons and go, okay, this is why, you know, get that into the conversation. But I agree with you. You could get lost trying to overanalyze this stuff, and it doesn't really serve the story. So I think you have to have enough of that in there so that people will believe the parameters that you've set up and they'll accept it, but you go beyond that, and because ultimately it doesn't make sense. There's no way something like this could possibly exist.
Right.
But I think if you put some parameters on that to kind of create at least a feeling of faux science, you know, with it, that people are going to accept that and say, okay, I'm going to buy it for this series. That's how this works, and that's fine.
So as long as it's logical, as long as we can buy into it, you know, you don't have to over-explain. Just set the parameters, and we can say, okay, those are the parameters. We can go from here. And that's a great thing about it. I like that. And that was one thing in the book I really enjoyed was the fact that you're setting things up, and clearly there's somewhere you're going with it. And so I really liked the fact that we can understand where we are, and as we go forward, we understand where that's going to be and how you've set things up. So I thought that was really well done. So, you know, as a writer, I think you do a really good job of setting these things up and telling stories as well as your great art. So this book, I think it ought to be a real big hit because, man, it's got all kinds of goodness to it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I hope it is. This is the kind of stuff, for as long as I've been doing comics, it's amazing that it's taking me this long to get here, but because I grew up, I was not just a kid who sat around and drew all the time. I wrote stories, and then I illustrated those stories is kind of what I did from, you know, my earliest recollection. I was always a storyteller and had a real passion for that as well. Mm-hmm. But you don't break into comics or film or anything else and go, well, I'm going to be a writer-director, or I'm going to be a writer-penciler, and, you know, you want to get hired as one and then get good at that and then say, okay, maybe now I can convince these guys to let me do this other thing I wanted to do as well. Mm-hmm. And as of right now, I'm writing and drawing, or about the start of the writing process anyway, for doing a Metamorpho series for DC. Mm. So this, the Power Cube hopefully will be the first step, and then Metamorpho the second step, and I'll hopefully be in a position where that I can do more of this mm-hmm. as my career moves on, because that's I get more enjoyment out of that than just drawing a script. Mm-hmm. Being able to write it and then draw it as well is really where I'd like to be all the time.
Well, I think this is off to a good start because I enjoyed the book tremendously. It's one of those things when you fall into the book and you don't realize time has passed and suddenly you get to the last page, you go, oh, it's not the end already, is it? You know, kind of stuff. And I really like that about that, and I think people will enjoy it. I think this is on some levels an all ages kind of story too. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Some people say if it's all ages, it's a dumb plot, but it's not. This is a very well thought out and cohesive plot going forward. So I think that on many levels, you don't have to be a specific kind of reader to read this book. I think as long as you enjoy a good story, this will be a book that you should be getting into. So
That was the hope when I came up with it. And the reason it is the way it is I harken back to when I got into comics, okay, mm-hmm. and I started reading comics in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And some of the storylines that stood out to me were, I remember an Avengers annual, I think it was Avengers Giant Size number 2, mm-hmm. where the swordsman was killed. Mm-hmm. And there was this love relationship between, he loved the Mantis, and Mantis loved the Vision, but Vision loved Scarlet Witch or whatever. And so the swordsman was always trying to get a relationship going with Mantis, and she would always reject him. And he ends up sacrificing himself to save her life. And then as he lays there dying, she's confessing her love and how she, you know, for him, and how she was wrong and treated him poorly and blah, blah, blah. But it was too late, he died. Now, to me, if you just tell that story to somebody, that's a adult story. But it was packaged in a way that any age group could pick it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I was 12 or 13 or whatever when that came out, mm-hmm. and certainly that would be a more mature situation than anything I had experienced as a 12 or 13-year-old, but I could still appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You know, I still loved the complex relationship that Peter Parker had with Mary Jane and early on in those relationships, you know. And mm-hmm. so I think you can deal with mature subject matter without it being a mature read, if that makes any sense at all. Where mm-hmm. I want a 12-year-old kid to be able to pick up this comic mm-hmm. and have his parents not be worried about it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't think it's dumbed down to, mm-mm. you know, a 12 or 13-year-old. I think it's written for an adult, but I think it can be just enjoyed as much by a kid. And that it's Raiders of the Lost Ark as opposed to the Terminator, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where you've got great adventure, fun. Everybody loves Raiders. Anybody of any age can go see it just mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. And it's entertaining for all ages. And that's really what my goal here was with this book, because I think we spoke a little bit of this, was that there's so much dark, serious, really mature type stuff going on in comics. I think part of that, and I know there's other factors involved like video games and things like that that are pulling kids out of comics, but I'm thinking, how do you ever get young new readers in when you're not producing books mm-hmm. that are accessible to them? Mm-hmm. And I don't ever agree with the idea of having a kid's line of books, I mean, except unless you're doing really young kids, you mm-hmm. know, like Tiny Titans or something like that. I think that mm-hmm. stuff is great. Mm-hmm. But if you want to get a 12 or 13-year-old in there, why can't he read Spider-Man? Why is there mm-hmm. stuff in Spider-Man or Batman or whatever that he mm-hmm. can't read?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a way to do stories that have adult or mature storylines in them without them being an M-rated comic. And so that's just always been sort of the way I look at things, and I know probably mm-hmm. there's a lot of people that don't look at it that way, but mm-hmm. I do kind of like the idea where comics used to be fun mm-hmm. and you could pick up any title and not really have to worry about, is this content going to be inappropriate for my 13-year-old kid?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm trying to do with this mm-hmm. book.
I wish there were more like that, to be honest with you, because I think you're right. We keep catering to an ever-diminishing pool of readers, And we've got to start to be able to reach out to people who are not currently reading comics. And I think that your book, Power Cubed, is a great start. I hope people look at it and learn from that and try to do stuff that way as well. So I think it's great
thank
stuff.
You. Thank
so
you very much.
It's Power Cubed. Number one comes out on September 23rd. Do you know when number two is going to hit?
I am guessing, since I am on schedule, which I'm happy to say, that these will all be out, then they would be, you know, 30 days later, which should be the last Wednesday of October, then the last Wednesday of November, then the last Wednesday of December, unless Christmas somehow messes that up in there for the fourth issue. But I don't have the dates specifically, but I'm pretty darn sure that that's what I'm planning anyway, is that they're going to be out 30 days later, you know, on schedule on that last Wednesday of the month.
Okay, so no Dark Knight Returns type scheduling going
on. No. No.
Okay, we won't do that. It's okay. Well, I highly encourage people to get the books because they're very good. The first one is terrific, and looking forward to the second one already. And I want to wrap up by asking you, I was looking at your website, of course, with your name on it, AaronLapresti.com, and you talk about a Teen Titans cover that's coming up for Halloween, and you do a nice explanation on there. And, of course, you can't really do it here because it's a visual thing. But let's just say that the cover turns out really gorgeous. I really love the cover, the way it finally turns out. And if you want to learn about drawing covers and about artwork and stuff like that, I think that this page is a really good one for people who want to go on. You present two different covers and how you chose between them and stuff. It's a really great explanation about cover work and stuff. And I just love that last one. I'm going to have to get that book for sure. But I just thought I would let people know that, so in case they wanted to learn about, you know, how you approach these things, that's a good place on your website to start out with that.
Yeah, thanks. There's actually archived several things on my blog. I try to get, when I do a cover, and after it's been, you know, out in previews, that it's actually been released and so I can talk about it, I'll try to blog about it and show the process of going from cover sketches to finished pencil to inks to colors. So there's actually, that's not the only one. There's several other ones on there. If you go back and look in archived on me explaining the process, and I've actually done that on some of the pages. Those people listening that have perhaps saw my Sword of Sorcery run with Amethyst a couple of years ago, it was interesting because that was never inked. That was all shot from my pencil, scanned from my pencils. And I also have a page on there in the blog that's archived about how I did that. And so there is some informative stuff on that blog for people that want to learn about technique or just get a better understanding of how some of this stuff is made.
Very good, and I wish you success with this. I see you're going to be up at New York. I'll be up there in New York, too. I'll try to stop by your table and say hi.
Please do.
At that time, because it's great stuff, and you know, you'll have a couple issues by then. Maybe I'll get them autographed by then. At that point.
There you go.
So good stuff. So, you know, keep up the great work, Aaron. And I can't wait to see your future stuff. You're off to a great start with this book. And, man, I hope you get to write and draw a lot more in the future.
Thank you very much, Wayne. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next week as we continue our countdown to episode 200. But until then, keep reading your comics.